students and educational developments. Dublin City FM.
Hello and welcome. This is Inside Education. My name is Sean Delaney. Coming up in today's programme.
If you pull somebody out of trouble, which I often did, and advised them, and were very, very important in their life for 10 minutes, you know, it was like a crossroads in their lives. Maybe you stopped them from going down the wrong road. Maybe you put something in front to help them. You know, that satisfaction level couldn't be priced. And I had that satisfaction.
I'll be speaking to a post-primary teacher who has just published his memoirs about his life in the classroom. The book is called Mr. Mac, A Blackboard Memoir, and it was written by Maurice McMahon, who taught for many years in St. Benilda's de La Salle College. But first, as always, we look at education news from the last week. One of the big stories this week in education was that of grade inflation. To discuss this story, I'm joined on the programme by Dr. Brendan Guilfoyle, who is a mathematician and a lecturer at the Institute of Technology in Tralee. He's also a founding member of the Network for Irish Educational Standards. The network was set up to investigate a pattern of improvements in Leaving Cert and college grades without any real improvements in learning. You're welcome to the programme, Brendan.
Thank you, Sean.
Brendan, you're saying that it's getting too easy to get a good grade now in a degree or in the Leaving Cert. But isn't it true that there was never really an agreed bar that had to be jumped over to be awarded an honours degree or an honour in the Leaving Cert?
Absolutely. I suppose, in education, of course, many of these things, it's very difficult to find absolutes. But what we did was we just looked at these award levels in actually both second and third level since 1991 to right through for about 15, 16 years. It's been updated since. And certainly what we found is that it has become easier to get awards, high-level awards in these. So it's a change in time, in temporal change that we're studying rather than absolute against some benchmark, which I guess really doesn't exist, I would have to say that. And the concern that we had, of course, is that the reasons why this were happening and the implications of this is, we have studied that and tried to understand the phenomenon itself.
So, I mean, couldn't there be legitimate reasons for it, say, such as more specialisation in terms of the courses that students are choosing, or more transparent exam marking systems, or higher parental expectations?
Yes, I guess there are many different reasons. So I guess when you look at the raw stats, as it were, which is just award levels, one could come to the conclusion, or very quickly, it doesn't take much to see that there's been significant grade increase. Mm-hmm. So that we make a clear distinction between that. We start off and gather the data. Now, I mean, the first point has to be made that this data had never been brought together before. So all the regulatory authorities, and I would have to say, teaching and learning centres, etc., across the country, none of them had ever even gathered this data together to study it in any context. So, I mean, that was a serious deficiency in the Irish education system, that this stuff wasn't even being looked at. When we looked at the data, of course, there was significant increase, grade increase, and then we tried to find evidence of what you're saying, of what could be causing. Could it be, better student ability, or the students getting, smarter, or better student motivation, as you pointed out, maybe that's a part of it, or maybe educational inputs. Maybe the universities and second level are getting better at teaching students, or students are learning better. And we pretty much discounted every single one of those. And, I mean, we've written 7 papers, 250 pages, in which we've gone through precisely all of these arguments. And there simply is no basis to conclude that these grades are warranted in the sense that they actually reflect any increased learning by the students.
So is it your conviction or belief then that grades should be on what is called a bell curve, where you have, say, roughly the same number of students failing as getting distinctions, and then you have a lot of students coming in at a fairly middle mark?
Well, I mean, we've never argued that per se. I mean, what you would hope, for example, is that if you have a course with high CAO point entrance, that there would be a higher level of first class honours award, that some there would be some juncture, you know, there wouldn't be a disjuncture, I should say, between second level and third level, and that you would have some education we were measuring in our exams, either the ability or the motivation and the performance of the students. And what we found is that there really is very little relationship between those two, and that this is what's the cause for concern. It's not clear what is being measured in these first class honours, and it's we compared it between disciplines, we compared it across institutions, and again, as I said, across time is the biggest concern, is that across time these awards become seriously devalued, which is our argument. And we you know, it's not a belief, this is something that we quantify and argue, quite exhaustively.
And Brendan, your own institution is the Tralee IT. And
yes.
Supposing I walk into Tralee IT and I ask who there is responsible for the calibre of your graduates and for, you know, the awards of the degrees, who would I be directed to?
Well, so the IOTs are under a single regulatory body, which is the HETAC, the Higher Education Training Awards Council, and so they're ultimately responsible for standards, educational standards. Now, they have delegated that authority to at different levels to the institution, so it's not a very simple question to answer from that point of view. But we found, and we've documented that over the period that we looked at, that HETAC significantly lowered. In fact, we found 20 rule changes over a period of 10-15 years, which allowed it for less and less able to get higher and higher through the system, as it were, migrating from certificates to diplomas and on to higher awards. Barriers, etc., of academic achievement were lowered. All kinds of things were changed. So the regulatory authorities, certainly in the IOTs, and we would also argue in the universities, completely failed in maintaining standards over the period that we looked at.
And Brendan, if we start to be strict on grades, will our students be disadvantaged when they travel abroad to countries that are more lenient in awarding high grades? And I'm thinking particularly, say, of the United States, where a lot of students expect to have, you know, a lot of A's in their results.
Well, this is a problem anyway. It depends where you see. It's very difficult to compare Ireland to or any country with any other country. If you look at America, I mean, this is a huge country. It has thousands and thousands of third level institutions, and you know, the it goes from the very elite right through to the kind of the college system. You know, so where are you talking about? I mean, generally, they know very well the standard at which the students are coming in at. You know, so I mean, I myself got my PhD in America, and I had a master's from Trinity, I remember, and I remember them taking out a big book and looking and making sure that it wasn't a master's that you could buy from Trinity, which you could after a number of years. So, you know, they become aware of standards. And also, if you're going into, say, graduate level, say, for example, you essentially have to go back to scratch in America. I mean, the American undergraduate system in general is somewhat lower standard, but the graduate level, they start afresh and they have 2 or 3 years of coursework, etc., and they try and bring people up to the level at which, you know, you can go for a PhD then.
Okay, and finally and briefly, Brendan, what do you make of Minister O'Keefe's proposal of a new agency to be responsible for qualifications and quality?
Well, this is, I'm afraid to say, it's a very disappointing result. Statement. I mean, the Minister indicated at second level there was no problem, but he didn't say anything to defend third level, and this is completely to miss the point. The two systems are feeding off each other, and as to forming a new body to oversee, well, the devil is in the details. Of the Universities Act going to be re-looked at? Are the universities going to are they going to lose their authority over standards? How's this going to work, you know?
Okay, Brendan, thanks very much for talking to me.
Okay, no problem.
Okay, thank you. And that was Brendan Guilfoyle from Tralee IT, and I'm sure we'll be hearing more about that issue in the future. You're listening to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM. My name is Sean Delaney. To get in touch with the programme, you can write to insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. Next, we have an interview with a post-primary teacher who has just written a Blackboard memoir about his life as a teacher. The name of the book is Mr. Mac, a Blackboard Memoir, and the Mr. Mac in question is Maurice McMahon, who retired a few years ago from teaching in St. Benilda's College in South Dublin. In the interview, he tells me about how students have changed over the years, what makes a good teacher, what his own teacher preparation was like, his regrets, and also a little bit about his famous father, the master, Brian McMahon. When I met Maurice McMahon, I began by asking him how he taught Irish.
I had no formal qualification in Irish, although The first class I did inherit was an honours. I did take up was an honours class in leaving cert. They got on flamingly. One of them got full marks in the old Irish. I don't think he got it from me though. So they had a basic Irish and a very good Irish from the local Kilmacud schools. It depended on what school they came from, their standard Irish. But I brought in the principal of Buntus for about 35 years. Now, Buntus, you wouldn't know it, but it was a computerised study of the language between 1930 and 1960 by Father O'Hoolacon in Gormanton College. The first computerised, and he worked out the drill patterns of a language. And it was incorporated then into a kind of a semi-comical series of booklets, 1, 2 and 3, plus tapes. And it was semi-Irish, semi-English. There was wonderful rhythms in it. Now, people laughed at me in that. I was maybe the purists didn't consider that very good. But my father, until the day he died, I saw him reading that book. Book one, he said, could get you through the junior cert. Book two, he said, would more than get you through the leaving cert. And book three, he said, you get a PhD out of it. And I saw him, and he was an authority in Irish. I saw him reading that book. Now, to prove the point, it worked every year. I had drill patterns. Nobody objected. They thought it was great fun. We smiled, we laughed, we looked at cartoons. We worked things into the cartoons. If a girl was there with an umbrella, we would say, where is she going to? Is she going to date and all that type of thing? And we gave the words and we scribbled all over that book. And they just immersed themselves in it and kept going over for 10 minutes. They were not allowed to do more than 10 minutes a night, ever. But the flash technique of learning worked. It imprinted itself on their brain. And to this day, a fellow stopped me a while ago and said, yes, mother good, Buntu still works. To prove the point, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, I went to study Spanish myself, having had Latin in school. And I based it totally on the Buntu's principles. And on my own out of a book, I got a B plus in the Spanish leaving cert from 6 months' study. The same principle transferred.
And am I right, Morrison, thinking that the Buntu's method used translation to English?
Yeah, but there was a wonderful vocabulary in every at the start of every chapter, maybe it's 10, 15 words, and then there was grammar, but they never called it grammar. They said it was kui niyaki and yaki. In three separate chapters, you get the positive, the negative, and the interrogative.
What were those words again?
Well, one chapter would be 16, maybe kuiche. I wouldn't call it the past, I wouldn't call it the amshakot, of course. The next chapter, 17, was niyakishe. And the next chapter again was Anyakashe. So after those three chapters, you knew Naimshakate and the Diarafach, Jultuch, Agus Kishtuch. But like those names are never used. And if it was grammar again, to be Trasna and Porke. Don't talk about the Shigindic to me because I didn't know it myself. But Trasna and Vo here. Trasna and Porke. And I likened it to a good musician. Once you brought the sound, you didn't have to know the note in question. And many musicians are by ear, and most languages are picked up by ear. But if they hear it right from somebody, they'll pick it up right.
But you didn't have a problem translating the text
to
English?
No. I broke into occasionally, just shoving in words of English. It didn't matter. I wasn't the purist in that sense. Now, the majority of fellows I would begin with had maybe difficulties with it, and they lapped it up. Then we could write essays and Timpish Bore of 25 lines and drop the hat. Once they had 20 words.
And what advice would you give to someone who finds the teaching of Irish
go
difficult?
Go to Buntu's. I still buy them. I bought one there 2 months ago from the Irish shop in Bray, and it still works. And I have set aside for my grandchildren because I don't know, find a good inspirational teacher would teach Irish anyway. But for those people who have never met a method that works, this works time and time again. I'll put my life in it. I call it the Buntu's principle.
And the other subject you taught, Morris, was history. What kind of methods did you use in teaching history?
I spoke very fast. I did great research. I prepared my classes. I threw everything I had at him. As for blackboard work, I tried everything from mnemonics to mind maps to what I call revision pages, where we boiled down everything onto one sheet. After about 10 classes on Bismarck, we boiled everything down to maybe 20 bullet points. And then, above all, I brought in a system which was essays every Monday morning on what we'd done for the previous 8 classes. And if I trained them like greyhounds, they brought in their essay copy, and I sat there reading the sports section. And from 9 o'clock to 20 to 10, they wrote their hands off. And the essay was taken off them. Anybody can manufacture an essay at home. Manufacturing in a class examination structure was incredible, and they produced the goods after about 6 weeks. Some of the efforts were very weak, but after about 2 months of training, like a greyhound, they came out of those traps and they could write an essay. Some of them could actually have been printed in the Irish Times for the honours class, and even the pass fellows found it no problem. Just practice.
So you just literally said to them, write an essay on Bismarck.
But then we would have studied Bismarck for 8 classes previously. I'd given them everything I could on Bismarck. Foreign policy, church policies, and they would have written up notes. There were about 20 pages of notes on Bismarck by the time I was finished, plus what's in the book.
And you mentioned mind maps there. For someone who doesn't know what a mind map is, could you just give a brief description?
I never mastered it myself, but I began to play around with it for the last 10 years. A friend of mine put me on to them, an economist. And it was like a big tree with branches, and everything is linked onto the branches. Before I brought that, I was never really happy that I understood it fully. It's like one simple diagram you can talk for hours, summarizes everything visually. Now, I did have a similar kind of mind map structure. Parnell, for instance. I had Parnell like a tightrope walker in a circus, balancing between the towers of New York, call it what you want. Now, Parnell had a hat in his head with 86. Now, 86 stood for 1986, which is the Home Rule Bill. 86 stood for the number of votes he had in the House of Commons. And if you multiplied, if you added the 6 onto the 86, it was 92. And that was the second Home Rule Bill. And then he was balancing, would he fall left or right off the wire? Would he fall into the peace territory or the gun territory? Because he had a foot in both camps. Pacifist or the Republican cause. And then if you fell down to the ground, that was the Land League. And on that one diagram, fellas, they would add to the diagram. We had 19 little points on one diagram of a man on a tightrope. And all that, they would jot down the diagram. They could write forever on it. But like, before you get to that stage, you have to know it. And then you boil it down like concentrated soup. It's like an Oxo cube.
What is it that makes a good teacher?
You have to have infectious enthusiasm. You have to be very, very you have to be passionate. You have to be very interested in human people. Everybody has a story. Every young fellow has a story. The secret is to get it out of them. And while something is, at times I would have realized was boring, I'd say, lads, ditch it. We'll talk about something else, something interesting. What do we talk about today? And the fact that you took cul-de-sacs meant that you were flexible. And you have to be flexible. I also had humour, a lot of humour in class. Now, it's like dynamite playing with humour. Dynamite, because it can explode. I learned the hard way. I know you had a captive audience, particularly juniors, they were only children. God forgive me, it was like my infants, as far as I was concerned, anything below junior cert. But the leaving cert, you were talking about men, and they could read you. They could read me better than I could read them. And so there was no point in trying to act with them. There's no point in saying, I know it all. I don't. I often admit to him I was 2 pages ahead of him. But I knew the 2 pages ahead of him. There's no point in pretending you knew something when you didn't know it. Bluffing. They'd catch you out instantly. I often had pupils in the back of class who were reading way books out ahead of me. And they'd be bored stiff and they'd be yawning, and I'd give them a wink and say, get out the big book. Go off, you go and do the World War or do Home Rule yourself at a higher level, because he had a big tome of a book inside under the desk. So you just had to be flexible. Each person had a gift. Each person had to be treated sacredly. And each person had to be treated as a total individual. There was no mass solutions or mass injections, you know, for the flu. Everything had to be tapered down to each individual.
And Morris, what was your own preparation like for becoming a teacher?
Disastrous in the sense of I did economics, honours economics, and I did honours history, which I adored. Now, they were both majors. There was only 3 of us did that combination of UCD in my day. One failed, one passed, and one got an honour. And I got not distinguished honour. The other fellow failed. But like, they were two huge horses. They should never have been ridden in tandem like a plough. I would have been better off one or the other. Now, economics, I put in the book, I might as well be looking up a duck's arse. But I got it by perseverance and learning off. But like history, I don't. And I met Sister Margaret McCurtain, Benvenuta, and she was my, in Irish, Ceann Rodaí. She was probably the best teacher I've ever come across.
What's that word, Ceann?
Ceann Rodaí. What person who leads the road for you, your inspiration, your lodestar, a guiding star, that you kind of admire from a distance, somebody inspires you. And, you know, she, I would model myself on her too. She was one of the big academic nuns, academics in Ireland history, Sister Benvenuta of the Dominican Order, Margaret McCurtain. She's now 80, so I wish her, send her happy birthday to her.
And that was the degree part of the preparation. What about, did you do a HDIP in education?
I did, and I taught Latin in my HDIP year. Latin. Sixth class, preparing to go to secondary school, having done 5 years, 3 years of glorious history and economics, I had to be assessed on the principle of mens sam and sam and sam and sam and sam and sam, teaching grammar.
What I'm wondering about, how well prepared then did you feel you were for secondary school teaching after the DIP?
Disastrously. I didn't learn a damn thing inside the DIP. Not a damn thing. It was theoretical, psychological, it was way off the wall. There was no practical guideline. Two of my own daughters are going into teaching, and they came through Freble. And the hands-on in Freble teaching is absolutely unbelievable, what I see now. So any time I had a DIP teacher, I always considered it a duty that I had to kind of take a DIP teacher every year. I did take a DIP teacher every year. And I sat in the back of that class and I said, can you take criticism? And I marked their card. And I said, you're doing this right, fantastic, you're doing that wrong. And then I sat up there and I said, no, you criticise me. Well, we're big enough to take it, two of us. And between the pair of us then, after about 3 weeks, he was flying solo. Otherwise, they're thrown in the deep end of a pool, these young DIP teachers.
And what kind of advice would you have given them? Can you remember any?
It's just simple, not turning your back in class, making sure your writing is good on the board, walk up and down between the seats, dress reasonably well, but not perfect, otherwise it's a model show. Watch for repeated words. My wife always said that they had a teacher who they drove to madness almost, because they counted that she said up 55 of courses in the class, of course. You have to have the ability to step outside yourself as a teacher, as a DIP teacher, and see yourself as if on a video. And I remember going down to UCD as a young teacher. One of my old teachers from Kerry was actually teaching in the DIP, and he asked me, would I do a demonstration class? And I did a demonstration class in 1971 on video. I often wonder, can I go back and get it to see what I was like? Because it was really kind of a high-powered teaching, but like I was also acting on a stage. The classroom was my stage. There was a certain amount of acting in it. You have to be an actor. And you have to concede when you're not right. I made a bags of that gentleman. How can we do this any better? So it's an interaction. It's like playing ping-pong. The ball has to go over and back and over and back. It's not just our side is all right. You'd write it down.
And you taught for 37 years altogether. 39. How did the students that you were teaching change over that period of time? Going back, you know, 39 years and then up to when you retired. The students different?
My glib answer to that is they were the same, because humanity doesn't change. It's like history. I don't think Hitler was any good, different from Caesar. Basically, he ate, he slept, he drank, he went with women, he went to the toilet. You know, there's a basic humanity. And Machiavelli said the same thing, that, you know, that there's a constant factor in humanity. And that's what I saw in the classroom. Now, the students, I didn't see much. Okay, they dressed better. Thankfully, they had more opportunities, because when I went to school, the best in my class had to emigrate. Now it was a meritocracy, an aristocracy of merit. If you had good enough academically, nothing could hold you back because you had scholarships for education. That was wonderful. That was the best thing of all. But, like, they dressed better, they had better suites, they had better bicycles, they had even cars on occasions. But behind all that, they were the exteriors. The interiors was the same problem, young fella growing up, having a teacher in front.
But what about, say, for example, the respect that they had for teachers? Did that change over those years?
So Machiavelli said long ago, you have to have to love you and hate you at the same time. That was in Book Il Principe. The ideal ruler, they have to love you and hate you at the same time. Now, that's a hard combination to get, because in between those two, there's respect.
Your father, Morris, was the master, and he wrote a book of that name. But you were the only one of your siblings who went into teaching.
My father, yes, he was a very well known and teacher, and all his students give him fantastic credit and praise. But to me, he was my father. He did write in the master. I got the master out of him on tape recorder. I taped it from him, word for word. I said, I give you 10 years, Dad, before you die and get Alzheimer's and carry all your knowledge with you. So I put a tape recorder, just like you put this in front of me, and I said, spit it out. And all told, I got 100 hours off him on his life.
So when I think of someone writing a book like that, I think of them drafting and redrafting it. So are you saying he actually composed that orally onto tape?
Yes, and I transferred every single word of it longhand and then gave it him, and he began to edit from that. What I had set up really was a production line. My wife was a fantastic typist and he had a secretary. So between us, he would never have gotten on to the autobiography on his own. But by doing the donkey work for him, he was able to get clean sheet, clean copy. Regularly, and it took 2 years, 3 years to do that.
The reason we're talking now is because you've just launched your own memoir, or you've just produced your own memoir. And did you work in a similar way to your father when you were writing yours?
Yes, my own biography is called Mr. Mac, a blackboard memoir. The actual hand graft of doing it. Rule number one, you apply bump to chair. Rule number two, you attack paper. Rule number three, you roll the paper up, throw it in the dustbin. Rule number four, follow him on, you attack again. And you keep writing. And I didn't realise I had cut my teeth with my father because I had been editing and writing. I didn't find it difficult at all to sit down and do my own. When the actual idea came to me, and I had no intention ever of writing, it was a chance comment by a parent in a queue in Tenerife when he recognised me that I had retired, and he said, you must have some stories to tell. I had never thought of it. Coming home on the plane, I had made out 20 chapters in my head. And then it was a matter of just 3 years writing.
One thing you told me that amazed me was that no secondary teacher has ever, in Ireland, written a memoir before.
This seems to be what Professor Coulihan has more or less highlighted. There was an inspector, I think, in Kerry who wrote a biography, but then he was an inspector who made has a little bit of experience in classwork, maybe a couple of years. The famous Galway footballer Jack Mahon wrote, only the teachers grow old, but I think that was more or less on football that he wrote, because he was a wonderful footballer in Galway, so I think he's mostly football in that, but no secondary teacher to my knowledge has done what I've done.
But isn't this a more general problem, Morris, among teachers, that they don't tend to write much anyway, and that when they retire, their wisdom is lost to the entire teaching profession?
There is a loss to teaching, yes, and I have made a plea in my own book that teachers should be kept on, even if it's only to kind of guide diploma students. Or there's a wealth of wisdom inherent in a lot of teachers after a lifetime that goes to waste. On economic grounds, you can't justify it.
And regrets?
Regrets. I doubt if there's a man in Ireland who hasn't regrets. Now, everybody reaches a glass ceiling in their life. I knew my limitations. I realised my limitations eventually. Disappointments, yes, I thought I could go farther in the profession from the point of view of hierarchy, but then again I would have lost contact with the class, with the actual class. I might have suffered withdrawal symptoms if I had been taken out of class and gone up the hierarchy in a bureaucratic situation. That was a regret in one sense, but there's no harm for me to get kind of a disappointment. Everybody gets it's coping with disappointment is a big question in life, not what regrets you have, because there are regrets every week. You can't relive your life again. But in all honesty, not one single one of my students had an All-Ireland bloody medal, and I was a GA fanatic. For my sins now. I've mellowed now in my anti-rugby stance, etc., etc. I've mellowed, but like not one of them, and that is the biggest regret of my life. Now, it's a flippant way of saying, yes, I suppose I was disappointed not getting promotion, etc., etc. But like, I think, had I got promotion, I think I can honestly put my hand in my heart now and say, had I got promotion to a vice principal, I'd be a dead man, because I was a workaholic. And I would have ground myself into the ground. My good father did say long ago, remember, he says, you can't bleed for them. And you cannot bleed for your students. Now, I tried on a couple of occasions, and I remember there was a very concerned parent. I didn't know what blood pressure meant. I didn't know what stress meant until I was about 60. But I think I've been suffering both for a long, long time. And I remember once going down to a mother and saying, I think you should take my pulse. And I think there and then she put me on a beta blocker. for a couple of days and said, if you don't stop, you'll be dead at the end of the week. But, like, it's satisfaction of giving. Now, whatever I gave in class, I got back tenfold from students in ways they could never even, I could never even verbalise.
And that was Maurice McMahon. The name of his memoir is Mr. Mac, A Blackboard Memoir. It can be purchased by contacting him directly by email at mrmacbenildis@gmail.com. That's all we have time for on this week's Inside Education. To listen to podcasts of previous programmes, you can go to our website, www.insideed.com. Or you can search for the programme on iTunes. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening. And Up and Down the Urban Music programme is next with Amit and Ali. And I'm sorry for running a bit over on them.